Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of June 8th, 2012. Teens across the country are breaking out the lawnmowers and ice cream scoops, hoping for a little extra cash in their pockets this summer. But whose money is it, really?
I think there's a very good case to be made for giving kids at least some financial independence as soon as you possibly can.
Mom, Dad, and money management, plus money wisdom from the commencement pulpit.
Figure out what engages you. What lights you up? Because when you love what you do, happiness and even financial success can flow from that.
And I head into the trenches for a little internship boot camp at The Soup.
One of the biggest jobs of being an intern here is watching television. Hours and hours and hours of really bad
that
television.
That sounds very taxing.
It is. I mean, you can only watch so many hours of The Today Show and The View before you want to throw up.
All that and so much more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
What else can I tell you? Well, I've got a few things. You will, at some point, probably move back in with your parents. I'm sorry, it's true, it's cool, it's only temporary, but go easy on them. They don't know what to do with themselves now that you're gone, but that doesn't mean they want you back forever. Try and save some money while you're there.
That was Adam Savage of Mythbusters fame speaking at the Sarah Lawrence College commencement ceremonies. It is that time of year, after all, when parents gather to watch their children go forth in the world. We'll hear from some other speakers throughout the show, but first to the news and one of our national obsessions, gas prices. Did you notice they're down 30, 40 cents a gallon this past month? Well, you didn't? Well, you must live here in California, but it is indeed the case. And so cheaper gas presumably means we all go back to our guzzling ways, or not. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has our story.
If I were a luxury car dealer, I'd go after oil analysts. They make good money. They drive to work in their suits, talking in those wireless earpiece things. Guys like Jamie Webster at PFC Energy. Except he drives a two-wheeler.
Coming up!
Webster cycles 22 miles into the office every day. I met him on the bike path along the way one morning, and he told me he ditched his car for a bike in 2007.
And the gasoline price started to kind of go up, and I'm normally a biker anyway, so I explored ways to try to figure out how to do this route. And once I figured it out, I pretty much just do it when the weather's nice.
Webster started biking when gas approached $3.50 a gallon. He says that's a price when many Americans start to make changes. We carpool, we combine trips, buy smaller cars. And we're still doing that because gas in general has stayed expensive. Webster says that while crude prices have fallen a little bit recently, there's still plenty of demand for oil.
It's a global market, and the places where you're really seeing a lot of the growth in demand is in Eastern Asia, China, the Middle East, Latin America.
Webster's bike commute has turned into a long-term habit, and he thinks the whole country is going that way. In geek speak, high energy prices are destroying demand. He sees the evidence here at a traffic light on the bike path we're on. Crowded.
January, February, March, as I was starting to bike, I knew it was going to be a pretty busy summer for bike commuters. And so I've seen, you know, 20, 25 bike commuters stacked up on that light waiting to cross.
Poor cyclists tend to be skinnier folks. And indeed, all of us are getting less energy obese. That's how economist Peter Terzakian in Calgary puts it. He thinks American oil use has peaked for good.
It is permanent. The commuter radius has stopped expanding. People are starting to drive a little bit less. And then importantly, people are buying more commonsensical vehicles.
Now, if you're skeptical, Terzakian understands. We've all come to assume that the earth turns, the sun rises, and Americans guzzle gas.
When you've had 2 to 3 decades of constant growth in oil demand and the whole notion of addiction, it's hard to believe that these changes are happening, but they are happening.
This kind of disruptive change doesn't happen often. The last time was in the 1970s. Phil Flynn at Price Futures Group remembers the Arab oil embargo. It cut us off from gasoline. We had to ration it.
And then all of a sudden, everybody was talking fuel efficiency. We started driving Pintos, for heaven's sakes. We were trying to catch up with Japan and get little tiny cars. I mean, it was crazy. But our world changed.
The car that would run and run and run and get lots of miles to the gallon.
Ah, the Ford Pinto. Back then, Americans moderated their oil habit. Even when the economy recovered, we drank modestly. Same thing this time, says Thomas Helbling at the International Monetary Fund.
In this recovery, vehicle miles traveled in the U.S. have stagnated. And this is in big contrast with other recoveries.
And on the bike trail, energy analyst Jamie Webster sees more and more type A commuter cyclists waiting impatiently at that intersection.
So you and I have this conversation in 5 years. There's going to be more traffic at that light?
I think so, yeah. It will be a trend that is just going to continue. That's not to say that I think the traffic in D.C. is going to go away.
Yeah, less D.C. traffic. That would mean all of us curbing our oil use completely. Way too much to ask for. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Summer jobs for high school age kids are a great thing. They learn about work ethics, stay busy, make friends, even make a little money. But who's in charge of that money once they've made it? Ron Lieber's here with some answers. He's the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. Welcome back.
Always good to be here.
So your kid goes out, earns some money, maybe at the local ice cream parlor, cutting a neighbor's lawn. Who is in charge of that money?
Well, much depends, right? I mean, if the kid is under 18, I suppose that you as the parent are in charge. It's not technically your money, but you make the rules, assuming the kid is living under your roof and the kid is a minor.
Right. But, you know, I guess part of this comes back to the question of when you start giving a little financial independence to a child. You know, do you start a bank account where they can put some of that job earning in there and then spend it as they please? Or is it something that you need to keep control over?
Well, so much depends on what the point of the exercise is, right? We have a certain number of teenagers who are working because they actually contribute to the household budget. They contribute to the overhead. The mortgage doesn't get paid without them contributing, maybe because mom or dad is out of work or they don't make very much money. It's also possible that the child doesn't have a car or doesn't have gas for the car, without earning the money, in which case the money gets spent on something very specific as soon as it gets earned. For families who... Where the kids are not necessarily sort of taking their money hand to mouth, so to speak, that's when you start to have choices. And I think there's a very good case to be made for giving kids at least some financial independence as soon as you possibly can.
If they earned it, and their idea perhaps is they should be able to spend it, how do you deal as a parent with the whole, it's my money, mom and dad?
Right. I think one way to have a conversation with a teenager about the money that they're earning is that, you start the summer, you start the job, with a conversation where you say, look, this money is going to be used for college, or it's going to be used for the purchase of your first used automobile. But you can also come to an agreement where, say, 10% of the money they make is theirs to spend as they please. Necessity is necessity, right? And if the child expects college to be paid for and the roof over the head to be provided and a vehicle, to appear in the driveway so that they can drive themselves to school, then what the parent or parents say goes.
Well, I think the lesson that you're really trying to get across here is that you just have to talk about it with your kids. But why do you think so many parents don't?
Well, if we're talking about money generally, one reason that parents may not want to talk about it is because they think that it's this sort of taboo topic, right? Or they're afraid of the kinds of questions that their kids are going to ask,
right,
say about, how much money the parents make. Another reason that some parents avoid it is that, they don't want kids to be money hungry or money grubbers or money obsessed. And they worry that if they introduce these topics too soon, then it'll become a topic of literal obsession for kids. And, that might be embarrassing for the parents if the kids are always talking about money or trying to get money. I think you can go way too far with that. I mean, the fact of the matter is that, teenagers are going to be financially independent independent sooner rather than later. So, you know, it makes an awful lot of sense to start talking to them about it, you know, in very sort of realistic and basic terms as soon as you possibly can.
Okay. Ron Lieber, the Your Money columnist for The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Good to be here.
And while some kids might be working this summer to save up for their new fall wardrobe, others graduating from college this June have something much bigger to worry about, the future.
I remember everybody, and I mean everybody, was asking me, do you have a job? Do you have a job? What are you going to do after graduation? You don't have a job? Oh my God, what are you going to do? Well, back then, I didn't realize that that what are you going to do question dogs you all your life.
Maria Shriver, speaking at commencement at the University of Southern California. We talk a lot about choices on this program. You can choose to save or choose to spend. You can choose to invest or not. Well, this week, the issue of consumer choice appeared front and center in New York City, where Mayor Michael Bloomberg proposed banning giant-sized sugary drinks. Also this week, Disney said it will not air ads for junk food during its programs. Commentator Justin Wilson says that is one full plate of the nanny state.
When it comes to tackling obesity, everyone agrees that something should be done to confront the problem. But the billion-dollar question is, what role should the government play in reducing obesity rates? Americans' understanding of public health is at a crossroads. The original intent of public health regulations was to protect us from each other. That meant working on worthy causes like improving sanitation at meatpacking plants and developing vaccines to prevent the spread of communicable diseases. But with those problems largely contained, the public health paradigm has changed. Now, many of those same regulators see it as their duty to protect us from ourselves. Mayor Michael Bloomberg's recent soda regulation rubbed many people the wrong way. In fact, a poll found that just 24% of Americans support his initiative. Our opposition to the paternalism of this policy isn't surprising. It stands in stark contrast to the ingrained sense of personal responsibility we share as a nation. Mayor Bloomberg justified his plan by arguing that the $4 billion he estimates obesity costs the city gives him a mandate for action. But the problem is this. Life is risky. From the smallest of risks, like a shake or two of salt on your dinner, to the largest of risks, like going skydiving, everything we do costs society. But that doesn't mean the mayor, or anyone else for that matter, has the right to regulate it. Obesity costs aren't any different from the billions of dollars that we spend on motorcycle accidents or slip and fall injuries, but you don't see the government banning motorcycles or mandating that pedestrians wear helmets. Those policies would undoubtedly save millions, if not billions, of dollars. But we would never tolerate it because we recognize that some risks are, well, worth the risk. Obesity is a product of personal irresponsibility. No one is forcing us to eat too much junk food or sit on the couch all day long and watch television. We're doing it to ourselves. Since personal irresponsibility got us into this mess, it's going to take personal responsibility to get us out of it. That is the proper role of public health. Government should provide consumers with incentives, information, and opportunities so that we can make smart choices and take responsibility for ourselves.
Justin Wilson is a senior research analyst at the Center for Consumer Freedom. Summer marks the end of the school year and the beginning of internship season. Students, of course, are looking to collect as many resume bullet points as possible. So instead of working on summer tans, they are working in offices, which is better for them anyway. For some tips on how to make the most of an internship, we have invited the self-proclaimed intern queen to our studios here in L.A. Her name is Lauren Berger, and she has a new book out called All Work, No Pay. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what qualifies you to be the intern queen? I do see a crown on your head.
I do have my crown necklace today. But when I was in college, I had 15 internships, which was sort of absurd. But I had these 15 opportunities. It was not planned. It was something that happened. And with each opportunity, I learned more and more about myself, what I wanted to do with my future. And I definitely learned how to excel in an internship.
How does one manage 15 internships in 4 years of college?
I would double and triple them up over the summers. I was going to school in Florida. I'm from Florida. And over the summers, I would go to New York. I would come to Los Angeles and I would intern and I'd be offered one internship. It would be unpaid because it was in the communications media field. Uh-huh. And they would say they needed me for 12 to 15 hours per week. And I would think, well, if I'm going to be in Los Angeles for the entire summer, I better put some more things on my schedule.
I think we are hearing a lot more about internships now because of the economy and the lack of jobs. So people say, well, I might as well go get, you know, some experience in an internship. Does that mean that it's more competitive out there right now just for unpaid internships?
I think it's definitely very competitive for both paid and unpaid internships, and probably the most competitive we've ever seen. And that's because of a few things. But I think around 2008, a lot of people were let go. A lot of interns were brought in to fill those positions, mm-hmm. whether that was ethical or unethical. I think it sort of depends on the business and how they structured it. But we really saw internship opportunities increase. And I think another reason is just because there was so much emphasis put on getting a job after college for these students. And to be the most prepared job candidate you can possibly be, you better have those internships on your resume. Not 15 internships. That's a little crazy. But I do suggest that students have at least two internships under their belt before they graduate.
Talk to us about what makes a really good internship for you, the intern? I mean, having gone through so many, you must have had some great ones and maybe some not so great ones. So for the employers out there who are looking at this, what's a really good experience?
When you ask this question, there's two things that come to mind. One is structure and the other is programming. Mm. I look for internships that have a lot of structure to them. Do the employers know what the interns are doing? Have the employers had that meeting among all their employees where they say, okay, this is the list of approved intern tasks and this is the list of unapproved intern tasks? When I say programming, I mean, what kind of cool events are the is the company coming up with for the students? For example, I interned at Fox, and one of the great things they would do is they would have these intern lunches once a week where interns would get to meet with one of the executives from the network, and that network would give a talk about how they got started, would give advice, would give one-on-one individual advice. So as a company, you don't realize sometimes that something as easy as having an executive meet with a group of interns, that can really be a life-changing, pivotal moment for these students. I think that one of the best things a company can do for their interns is bring them into meetings. Just having a student sit in the background quietly, take notes, and observe is a powerful lesson. And it's something that the students don't do in the classroom.
Well, let's get to the role of the intern, him or herself, working for a company, perhaps for free, perhaps for a little bit of pay. What do you think their responsibility is to the company?
In my opinion, the intern's responsibility is to go in there every single day, dressed sharply, volunteering for everything, great attitude, cell phones tucked away, not on Facebook when they have downtime, and they need to ask themselves every single day, how can I make the most of this opportunity? Uh-huh. And if they're consistently doing that, not just the first day, a lot of students get caught up in that first impression. They're always told it's the first impression. At the internship, it's the lasting impression.
Lauren Berger is the intern queen. I do love the crown that you have around your neck.
Thank you. That's wonderful.
Her book is All Work, No Pay, Finding an Internship, Building Your Resume, Making Connections, and Gaining Job Experience. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Hi.
Tess?
Yes.
Hi.
Hathaway?
I'm Kira.
I'm
Hathaway.
Oh, hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet
you. I'm your new intern.
Hi, I'm Kira.
Hello.
Very nice to meet you. Want to come this way, I guess?
Okay.
It has been exactly 25 years since my first internship. So while we're on the subject, why not try another one? And why not do it in Hollywood at one of the coolest shows on television, The Soup? with my new boss, supervising producer Hathaway Loftus.
Ed, this is Tess, our
Hi.
Intern.
Hello. Very nice to meet you.
This is our big intern for the day.
Yes. So Edward is our executive producer.
All right. Well, just let me know if you need some coffee.
Yeah, I'm not like that, trust me.
But this is Matt Carney, and he actually helps out a lot with the interns and making sure they're doing their jobs.
And I was once an intern.
He was. He started as an intern and is now a producer.
In fact, four of the show's 14 staff members started as interns. That, of course, is one of the reasons to intern. It might land you a job. In fact, my first of four was at Oregon Public Broadcasting after my freshman year at college. They actually put me on the air. And when I graduated 3 years later, they hired me. So, full disclosure, I believe in internships. We'll find out later whether I get hired at The Soup.
One of the biggest jobs of being an intern here is watching television, hours and hours and hours of really bad
that
television.
That sounds very taxing.
It is. I mean, you can only watch so many hours of the Today Show and The View before you want to throw up. But the point is we give you guys those shows so that you can find stuff and we don't have to watch them anymore.
The Soup for the Uninitiated is a clip show of absurd and outrageous videos from across the TV spectrum. So I and two other interns spent the rest of the morning watching really, really bad TV.
Single moms move in.
Her son started beating up my son.
And things go up in smoke.
Is that reggae music and the calmness thereof accompanied by weed smoke?
Next, Judge Mathis.
Okay, I'm just going to go through maybe a couple things, see if I can find anything for you.
Yeah.
And then for the pitch meeting, you have to be able to make a case for your clip.
You pitch it. You tell the group why you thought it was funny. So if you want to...
Okay.
Step in.
I will start watching.
It was Anthony Trolley's first day as an intern, too. He's 19, goes to the University of Laverne.
I've only started watching one show, and I'm a little bit into it. And
what show is it?
I'm watching When Vacations Attack.
Fortunately, his pals all stepped out of the way, so the tree was able to stop him.
It's a bit horrifying, some of the stuff, but it is entertaining.
So have you found any clips yet?
Yeah, I've found one clip.
That you're going to pitch?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I'm going to pitch it yet.
What are you hoping to get out of this?
I'm going to be a writer, so hopefully be consistent enough to where I'm taken seriously and someday get a job, at least get glowing recommendations.
What are you watching?
I am watching Mysteries at the Museum.
Eliana Levinson started her internship at The Soup 3 weeks ago. She's 20 and goes to Barnard College.
It's all about artifacts that you might find at a museum.
Is it hilarious?
It is over-dramatized, which makes it funny when you're watching the whole show.
Wagons that once rode the Oregon Trail, steam-powered locomotives, and a cannon that predates the Civil War are just a few of the artifacts housed in the Kansas Museum of History in Topeka, Kansas.
But clip by clip, it's not, always the funniest. But you get a great history lesson.
What are you hoping this internship does for you?
I actually also want to be a writer. So I'm hoping to get a feel for the way that a big company runs. Be able to use it as like a springboard of not only knowledge, but contacts that when I graduate in 2 years, I'll be able to say, hey, remember me? I interned for you. Hire me, please, so that I don't live on the streets or back home.
Hey, Anthony, will you bring one of those chairs from the Avid over here?
Intern duty.
That's right.
Both Levinson and Trolley said their parents are supporting them while they work for corporate America free of charge. Internships at The Soup are, like many if not most other internships, unpaid. And that aspect of the intern world sparks debate pretty much every year around this time. But a study 2 years ago by the National Association of Colleges and Employers showed that new college grads who did internships were more likely to get job offers than those who didn't.
Okay, I have chairs. Where do they go?
Too late now!
Oh, no! Did I screw up already?
Yes, part of my job as the Soup intern was to set up chairs for the pitch meeting.
This week we have, we're shooting two shows on Wednesday, the first of which will be our regular episode, the second of which will be Lee and Kelly's special, which will be Soup 925,
yes.
Numbered-wise, right? Yes.
Executive producers K.P. Anderson and Edward Boyd, along with the rest of the staff, gathered around a long conference table to watch what was supposed to be the very best of the day's viewing, including a local TV news clip where one anchor is clearly not listening to the other.
Listen, it's Kristen and John Paul Duran's 11th anniversary.
Happy birthday.
That one did make the final cut, as did clips from my two fellow interns. But me?
When Vacations Attack, no. Lion's Den, yeah, the last one. And then none of the other ones. You failed us, NPR.
Yeah. Give me a couple of days.
You will not get college credit for this week.
Good thing that first internship 25 years ago turned out a little better.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
America needs your talent and skill. If we take the right course, I am convinced we're going to see a resurgence in the American economy that will surprise the world and that will open new doors of opportunity for those who are prepared as you are.
Now more than ever, America needs what you, the class of 2012, has to offer. America needs you to reach high and hope deeply. And if you fight for your seat at the table and you set a better example and you persevere in what you decide to do with your life, I have every faith, not only that you will succeed, but that through you, our nation will continue to be a beacon of light for men and women, boys and girls, in every corner of the globe.
That was presumptive Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney speaking at Liberty University and President Barack Obama at the Barnard College commencement. Both talked about skills they say America needs to be competitive. But many of those skills come with the high price tag attached to a university degree. Economists talk about a college degree as a signaling device, a way to show employers that you're a smart, responsible person who won't, say, take three-hour lunch breaks or permanently borrow furniture from the office. But that is pretty expensive proof. And as more people question the value of a college degree, they are looking for cheaper credentials. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott has that story.
You hear it all the time on shows like this one.
Employers are demanding college degrees as a bare minimum.
Employers are fixated on college degrees.
Without some form of post-secondary education, it's very unlikely that you will be able to reach or stay in the middle class.
And yet, the people who do the hiring say today's college graduates aren't cutting it.
Employers are telling us we're not doing a good enough job on critical thinking, communication skills, problem-solving skills.
Most employers are ready to hire, but they can't find the talent they need.
The number one concern right now is finding skilled people.
Employers are hungry for better ways to measure a job applicant's skills. At the same time, individuals are looking for cheaper ways to get an edge in the workforce. Enter alternative credentials, which offer new ways to certify what people know.
We are in our global headquarters. So we're really not global. But the
Burke Smith is showing me around the offices of Straighter Line, a startup in Baltimore that offers low-cost online courses. Students get credit at partner universities. And starting this fall, they'll be able to bolster those credits with something new, a critical thinking score.
Employers say frequently that the one thing they want from new employees are critical thinking skills.
You know, the ability to solve complex problems, synthesize information, make decisions based on reason. Colleges measure these skills with a test called the Collegiate Learning Assessment. It's used mainly by schools to evaluate their teaching. Smith says Straighter Line will offer a version of the test directly to students for less than $100.
So students could put together 15 or 20 of our courses, they have a critical thinking skills score of X, they can take that to an employer and say this is comparable to a two-year degree, it's cheaper, it's faster.
In April, Dove Goldstein graduated with a bachelor's degree from an online university. He took a handful of low-cost courses at Straighter Line. He also got credit for knowledge of Hebrew and Jewish studies.
So for my full bachelor's, it probably costs between $7,000 and $8,000.
Goldstein says he'd be interested in adding a critical thinking score to his degree.
Employers, you know, they're also going to be looking for, you know, other things which kind of, you know, stand out over other people trying to get the same job.
There are other types of alternative credentials headed onto resumes. Say you sign up for a course in circuits and electronics at MITx. That's MIT's popular new program that lets students take courses online for free. Harvard has a similar program. You won't get college credit for the class, but you can earn a certificate of mastery.
For a long time, the only way that people could really prove or demonstrate those kind of skills in the job market was the college degree.
Kevin Carey is director of education policy at the New America Foundation, a nonprofit think tank. He says if enough people bring credentials like certificates of mastery to employers and then do really well at their jobs,
those letters will mean just as much as a traditional college credit in the long run.
Another idea that's gaining traction is straight out of Girl Scouts. Remember those badges handed out for skills like cooking and pitching tents? This year, the MacArthur Foundation and Mozilla held a contest to spark ideas for digital badges.
A digital badge is something you can put on your website that basically says that you've been credentialed in a certain skill.
Kathy Davidson co-founded the group Haystack that ran the competition. Eventually, she says an employer will be able to click on your resume and see that you earned a badge in something as technical as robotics or as hard to quantify as teamwork or leadership.
For example, Google last year did a big survey of what made a Google employee valuable. And things like ability to communicate complex ideas to one's coworkers turned out to be very, very important.
So let's say I don't have a college degree. Can I go out with my collection of digital badges and a critical thinking score and compete with college grads for jobs? Not yet. But Davidson says big tech companies like Google and Microsoft are already using badges in hiring. And as more employers start taking alternative credentials seriously, they could challenge the monopoly of the traditional college degree. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Figure out what engages you, what lights you up. Because when you love what you do, happiness and even financial success can flow from that.
The need to serve others has never been greater in our nation. Money and position will or will not follow, but satisfaction will always be there. Always have a purpose in life that is beyond position and money.
Make career decisions the same way you fill out your tournament brackets. Follow your heart and go with your gut. Do what you love, find a ways to get paid for it, and if you ever have the luxury of multiple job offers, don't make the decision based on salary alone.
All right, so journalist Bob Woodruff, former Joint Chiefs Chairman Colin Powell, and New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg all say to pick a job you love. But it's easier said than done, isn't it? Especially when there are many more unemployed Americans than there are jobs. Well, Peter Capelli has another reason to pile on the misery. He teaches management at the Wharton School and says the fundamentals of hiring are broken, mostly because of the heavy reliance on technology to screen candidates. His new book is Why Good People Can't Get Jobs. Professor Capelli, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You write in the book that the modern hiring process itself has some inherent problems, especially employers who are pretty much using the internet to pick their candidates. But I thought the internet was supposed to make everything easier.
I think what the internet ends up giving us is scale. So you can contact lots more people and lots more people can contact you. I suppose the question to ask yourself is that a good thing? Mm. And it turns out in hiring, it can be quite a bad thing. And the reason it's a bad thing is because you are interested in fit.
Do you have any statistics on the number of jobs that go unfilled every month because employers simply can't find this right fit?
Well, now that's it's a very good question as to what that actually means. I think when we get these arguments about jobs that we can't fill because we can't find anybody, that's really the self-diagnosis of the cause of the problem. Because remember, everything is roughly within the control of the employer, right? They define the job, they set the requirements, they set the screening practices, they set the rate of pay, they determine how they market the job, how they recruit, and then they make the decision as to which recruits to take. So when they say, I can't find anybody, it could be because of all kinds of reasons. Right now, for example, we know that when we come out of recessions, it typically takes employers longer to find people. That is, vacancies stay open longer.
Why?
You know, if there's only one person out there and you got a job, you really need it done, you don't bother spending a lot of time pondering. You just grab the person and off you go. But if you've got thousands of applicants and you think there's a pretty good chance that there's, as they say, the purple squirrel out there, you know, the completely unusual person who is just perfect for the job, you take more time and search.
The purple squirrel?
Yeah, I understand this is a long-standing term in the world of information technology. And it basically refers to that candidate that's just so rare that you rarely ever see them.
You know, I think it makes sense, this idea that hiring software just can't do this for you. I mean, not only can it probably not tell a good egg from a bad, but it can't give you gradations of candidates.
And I think even more than that, the way software has to work typically is as a series of yes-no, yes-no, yes-no gates. Well, once you start building a series of these gates in, let's say the odds are 50% that a typical candidate would be able to clear the first gate and then 50% clear the second gate. Clearing both gates is a 1 in 4 opportunity then. And once you get 10 gates like that, it's a 1 in 1,000 chance. And once you get more than that, you're up to the purple squirrel situation.
You're right that a lot of folks get overlooked for some really trivial stuff. You know, they have a slightly different title than the job they're applying for. Maybe that they even use the wrong font on the resume. How do you know from employer to employer what you're supposed to look like on the page?
I think the advice, which is not going to surprise you, is to get around the software if you can.
Yeah.
And that is try to get to a real person.
Right.
It's, you know, employers will say, we have to go through the software. And that's true. Often you do. But that doesn't mean you can't start by talking to a real person, somebody close to the hiring manager, and be able to persuade them that even if you don't have on paper the perfect characteristics, you're maybe even ideal once you can describe what you can do.
Yeah. Tell us the story of Fernando Boero. He was the mechanical engineer. He had a master's degree, a professional license, 30 years experience, but he couldn't type 65 words a minute.
Right, right. So this particular story was of an engineering job with some requirements that were kind of crazy, and one of them was this typing speed requirement.
For an engineering job.
For an engineering job.
Right.
I heard one from somebody this week who told me that in this particular company where they basically packed vegetables, they were looking for a marketing executive, and they required that the marketing executive have experience with green olives. as opposed to black olives. There's a lot of those things. And I think a lot of people want to bash the HR community for this problem, but I don't think they're responsible. I think actually they were the solution to a lot of these problems, but they're gone now.
Yeah.
So companies downsized, got rid of people, tried to substitute software for them. In the old days, the HR recruiting manager would talk to the line manager who says, you know, we need an engineer to type 65 words a minute. And they'd say, come on, do you really need that? Does this job really require a master's degree? And there'd be some pushback. And now those people are gone.
Peter Capelli is a professor of management at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And his new book is Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, something a lot of people are wondering these days. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
If there's one event that can compete for high school seniors' attention, even even more than graduation, it's prom. Prom season's been running for a few weeks now, and parents are spending big for the occasion, no matter how tight the household budget might be. Bridget Bodner put on her best finery and went shopping with some soon-to-be prom goers.
The Mint Collection in Los Angeles is floor to ceiling, rhinestones, sparkles, and feathers.
Pretty.
There's a steady stream of high schoolers coming and going, and a lot of them have mom in tow.
Really not, but I want to try it on.
The Mint Collection is a dress boutique, and this is prom season. Claudia Thompson, with a K, is a senior from a suburb of LA. She's done a lot of spending for the night.
It's already been like $700 with just tickets and one dress, so it's my senior prom. Like, it's just what we've been waiting for 12 years, and it's pretty much like, this is it.
Claudia was shopping with her mom, also named Claudia, but with a C. Mom Claudia still needs to buy her daughter shoes, flowers, pictures, transportation, on top of that $700 they've already spent. That's a lot of money for a single mom, and Claudia doesn't have a budget for the night. She'll spend what it takes to make her daughter happy.
Well, she earned it. She earned it. I'm excited for her. I didn't get to go to prom, so I'm living vicariously through my daughter.
Claudia is willing to make big sacrifices to give her daughter what she wants. 2 years ago, Claudia was unemployed.
If it would have taken place back then, I think I would have probably worked at McDonald's if I had to, but would have given her the same as I'm giving her now.
Judging by the number of mom-daughter pairings at the Mint Collection, there are a lot of parents like Claudia. Kit Yarrow is a consumer psychologist at Golden Gate University in San Francisco. She says many parents are willing, even eager, to break the bank for their child's prom.
We are finding every year that people spend a little bit more on prom. And even at a time when the economy was turning down, we still saw people really indulging in prom.
Yarrow says it's because Americans think about prom differently now than they did a generation ago.
So in 1980, the average age that a girl would get married was 22. Today, it's closer to 27, and a great percentage of people in their 20s don't marry at all. And so I think that what's happening is that proms are replacing in some ways that coming-of-age party, the wedding, the debutante ball. These things are either postponed or they're not done anymore. And parents need in some way, you know, an occasion to celebrate their kids' transition to adulthood. And I think that that's become the prom.
A recent poll by Visa found the average family expects to spend about $1,000 on prom. Paula Rosenblum is an analyst with Retail Systems Research, and she says there's an element of compensation in all of this new spending. She says the urge to spend on a big party is a natural reaction to the downturn of the last decade.
We've gone through uncertain times for so long that a certain amount of frugality fatigue has set in, and consumers really would prefer to open up their wallets and enjoy themselves, particularly on special life events like a prom.
She says parents who feel guilty about not being able to pay for college might be trying to make up for it on prom. Outside the Mint Collection, I bumped into a young prom-goer called Paola. She hasn't even bought her dress yet, but she's finding prom is already getting expensive. The ticket alone is $85.
But it's going to, like, end up being $100 if I don't pay soon.
In all, she's expecting to spend $500, a budget laid out by her parents who are footing the bill. But Paola wants to spend more, and she will if she can find a job. She says it's important to make sure the night lives up to her high expectations.
Because it's a night to remember, I guess you can say. I don't know, maybe because like, I just saw like my parents' prom picture, so I know that it's going to last forever, and people are going to see it when I grow old and stuff.
Her prom spending may sound excessive, but Paola's not extravagant by nature. Her plan is to go to community college in the fall because she wants to save money.
Yeah, that's why I'm going to do the 2 year and then hopefully transfer if like the economy doesn't get better by then. Just try to transfer to anything I can at the moment.
So for her, prom is one last spending hurrah before she buckles down to frugality. I'm Bridget Bodner for Marketplace.
The show, we've heard from the cream of the crop of 2012's commencement speakers. The term soaring rhetoric certainly comes to mind. Commentator Charles Wheland offers up some alternative advice.
I know that I'm supposed to tell you to aspire to greatness, but I'm going to lower the bar here for a minute. I'm going to ask, first and foremost, that you do not use your prodigious talents to mess the world up. Too many smart people are doing that already. It's true that high school dropouts are more likely to steal cars, or go to prison, or end up on welfare. But if you really want to cause social mayhem, it helps to have a college degree. And the Ivy Leaguers can be the worst of all. To make that point, I want to speak for a moment about an iconic photograph from 1994 that embodies the capacity of smart, highly educated people to do really nasty things. In April of that year, the heads of seven major tobacco companies appeared before Congress. They were all sworn in. The famous photo I referred to is of the seven executives all taking the oath at the same time. All seven of them proceeded to testify before Congress and the nation that cigarettes are not addictive. As I said, this was 1994, not 1924 or 1934. The Surgeon General had already reported that tobacco is as addictive as cocaine or heroin. In prepared testimony, William Campbell, president of Philip Morris, stated unequivocally, quote, "cigarette smoking is not addictive," end quote. This is, by the way, after decades during which the same companies had deliberately obscured the causal relationship between smoking and cancer, despite plenty of research making that clear and compelling link. Among the seven who took the oath and testified that day that cigarettes are not addictive, there were a lot of impressive degrees. Three of them were from Harvard. You are smart and motivated and creative. Everyone will tell you that you can change the world. They are right. I'm going to remind you that, quote, changing the world, end quote, also includes things like skirting financial regulations, obscuring climate change research, designing subprime mortgages that low-income families will not understand, and selling unhealthy foods to increasingly obese children. If you work hard and focus, you could probably be awesome at all of those dastardly deeds, creative, even innovative, in a diabolically underhanded way. But, to paraphrase Nike, just don't do it. I'm not asking you to cure cancer here. I'm just asking you not to spread it, literally in the case of the unapologetically dishonest tobacco executives, but figuratively in the rest of your life. If that is not enough, let me add parenthetically that this, too, will make you happy. All of the research I've ever seen on this topic is very clear. Leading a life with purpose, however you define that, is strongly associated with happiness and well-being.
Charles Wheland is the author of 10 and a half things no commencement speaker has ever said. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to, oh my, the U.S. Embassy in Tbilisi, Georgia. That is where Kirsten Michener works. She's a senior democracy and government advisor with the U.S. Agency for International Development. Kirsten wrote us to tell us about an intern with her office. Yes, an intern named Marcia.
She asked if she could have lunch with me and talk about my career path. And I was very happy to talk to her about that. And then sort of at the end of the conversation, I mentioned from one woman to another that she should start saving for retirement the day she lands her first job, because I really wish that someone had given me that advice 20 years ago. And she actually just turned 23 2 days ago, so I fairly begged her to start a Roth IRA as soon as she gets the first paycheck. And she listened. She came back with intelligent questions, and she sent me an email after lunch. She was kind of chewing on the things that we talked about, and I had sent her something about the miracle of compounding with the example of, you know, if you put $100 a month aside in your 20s and then how that compounds and how much it adds up to in your 60s. She sent me back intelligent questions. So we had another lunch, and we had a little tutorial from all the things that I learned on Marketplace Money. And I was just so inspired by this wonderful young woman.
Now, Kirsten wrote in to suggest we give a piggy to Marcia, which we are happy to do as she gets started on her new savings habit. But you know what? You get one too, Kirsten, for being a great teacher and prompting this young woman to think about a future that I'm pretty sure seems far, far away. And for that, we thank you. Piggy is extremely excited to come live with you across the pond. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Tess Vigeland. Next time, fatherhood has, for many men, gotten more complicated in recent decades, but some things have stayed pretty much the same.
When you put your kids on the payroll, there are still just two business models: parents who make their kids do stuff and parents who don't.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson, help this week from Mary Dew. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Yore. I am Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.